And good morning, and welcome once again to The Other Side of Midnight. I'm your host, Richard C. Hoagland. Well, this morning we have a remarkable show. A remarkable show at a remarkable period of time. Remember, The Other Side of Midnight is that period between dusk and dawn where the things we would look at in daytime and go, ah, come on. We can look at it this time of night and say, maybe, just maybe, it would work. I want to start with what we left off last night, or early yesterday morning, Robin Falco's report from Iron Mountain. I don't know whether people in the audience actually understand what a blockbuster, what an extraordinary revelation this is or this was, because for years, actually for decades, Iron Mountain has floated around as this, kind of like this show, the you know, between dusk and dawn. Is it real? Is it not real? Is it a hoax? Was it a very elaborate psychological test? Well, we now know, because of the Obama White House declassification of some 2,500 CIA PDBs for the president, those are presidential daily briefs, from the years 1961 to 1969 that were released 2 days ago, that on the morning of October 1, 1967, President Lyndon Johnson received a briefing on the report from Iron Mountain, and that that briefing in the CIA documents, which are linked to yesterday morning's show, so if you want the documentation, go to othersideofmidnight.com, click on yesterday's show, the guest link, that will take you to the guest page. And at the top of the page, there are a whole series of links, the Iron Mountain Report and the various now confirmations of its reality vis-a-vis this new CIA declassification. The fact that the first briefing of the president on this report is missing from October 1, and when you scroll down to the second briefing, which we are aware of now from other CIA documents, the titles of the papers, the titles of the briefs, and you find that that one is totally redacted, even though there are many other links and many other papers available and many other reports in the documents that have not been redacted. It does make you wonder seriously, very seriously, if in fact there is some strange, even now, cloud around this report. Because remember what the report says. It's a report on the alternatives to war that was put together by high-level government officials in the 1960s, according to the documents, and then brought a huge group of specialists in a variety of fields, from education to military to economics, industrial production, sociology, all kinds of different experts, very much like Brookings. And the conclusion was there are several possible alternative scenarios for the culture of this planet to engage in activities that are not head-to-head human conflict where people are killed deliberately. But each of those alternatives in the document is laid out with great specificity as carrying some terrible prices. Ultimately, what the report was recommending, that if we were to look at, as a species, an activity, a human activity of the scale of warfare that would occupy the hearts and minds and consciousness of humankind, it would have to be done through massive social engineering, massive media programming, and the details, as Robin went into them last night. When you look around, when you actually look around at what is occurring in this society, it is eerily parallel in so many ways to what we are seeing in our major media, in politics, in international relations, in the spread of the extraordinary fear porn around terrorism in all its forms. In other words, we appear in the second decade of the 21st century to be living out the recommendations of the Iron Mountain Report. And the critical linchpin that connects the vague possibilities of warfare transfer to other activities in that document, in fact, seems now to be taking place quietly, without anyone being aware, all around us. Now, the way that feeds into this morning's program is that we're going to be talking about what one might colloquially term the Marvel Universe, this fictitious universe created from comics, now transferred to major tentpole films, where hundreds of millions of dollars are spent in, you know, multi-part sagas set, you know, between reality and fiction, reality and science fiction, reality and God knows what. And the parallels between these two universes is extraordinarily eerie. Before we get to our guest, I want to play a little clip from Captain America, the Winter Soldier, which appears to very aptly link these two island universes together. And when we finish listening, we will then go to our morning's guests.
Rogers, Stephen, born 1918. Romanov, Natalia Alyanovna, born 1984.
It's some kind of recording.
I am not a recording, Fräulein. I may not be the man I was when the captain took me prisoner in 1945, but I am.
You know this thing?
Arnim Zola was a German scientist who worked for the Red Skull. He's been dead for years.
First correction, I am Swiss. Second, look around you. I have never been more alive. In 1972, I received a terminal diagnosis. Science could not save my body. My mind, however, that was worth saving. On 200,000 feet of data banks, you are standing in my brain.
How did you get here?
Invited.
It was Operation Paperclip after World War II. SHIELD recruited German scientists with strategic value.
They thought I could help their cause. I also helped my own.
Hydra died with the Red Skull.
Cut off one head, two more shall take its place.
Prove it.
Accessing archive. Hydra was founded on the belief that humanity could not be trusted with its own freedom. What we did not realize was that if you try to take that freedom, they resist. The war taught us much. Humanity needed to surrender its freedom willingly. After the war, SHIELD was founded, and I was recruited. The new Hydra grew, a beautiful parasite inside SHIELD. For 70 years, Hydra has been secretly feeding crisis, reaping war. And when history did not cooperate, history was changed.
That's impossible. SHIELD would have stopped you.
Accidents will happen. Hydra created a world so chaotic that humanity is finally ready to sacrifice its freedom to gain its security. Once the purification process is complete, Hydra's new world order will arise. We won, Captain. Your death amounts to the same as your life, a zero sum. As I was saying...
What's on this drive?
Project Insight requires insight. So I wrote an algorithm.
What kind of algorithm? What does it do?
The answer to your question is fascinating. Unfortunately, you shall be too dead to hear it.
Steve, we got a bogey. Short-range ballistic. 30 seconds tops.
Who fired it?
SHIELD.
I am afraid I have been stalling, Captain. Admit it. It's better.
Well, I'd like to introduce and welcome this morning Dr. Travis Langley, Jaina Bush, Dr. Janina Scarlett, and Dr. Martin Lloyd. Welcome to The Other Side of Midnight and the introduction of, 1945 psychology to 2015 mass cultural media. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. Yes.
Thank you so much for having us.
Oh, it's very nice, as my grandmother used to say, to be had. Travis, let's start with you. You're a PhD psychologist, and you've authored many, many books on this subject. Just a couple of them here: Batman and Psychology, A Dark and Stormy Night, spelled with a K. You've been editor of The Walking Dead Psychology, The Psych of the Living Dead, Star Wars Psychology, Dark Side of the Mind. How does a psychology professor get into, who has actually had a career in crime and mental illness and social behavior and media, how do you wind up encapsulating and trying to understand a fictional world that is now we are becoming very, very cognizant of? Maybe not so fictional after all. Hello? Dr. Langley? Hello? Oh, that's interesting.
All right.
Are you there, Dr. Langley? Hello? Hello? Earth to Dr. Langley. That's very peculiar. I'm not hearing anything in my headphones. So tell you what, let's go to a musical break, and I will try to reestablish contact with all our guests this morning. For some reason, just when you need it, technology never, never seems to work. So let us take a walk on the other side of midnight, and we'll come back right after these words. There's our chorus.
Oh,
I think we have solved our technical problem by looping through Megasat 1 on the far side of Pluto.
Fantastic.
Anyway, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Dr. Langley, did you hear my setup question, and do you have any? Okay, so go for it.
All right. Once upon a time, I was born.
You have to lean a little forward toward your mic.
Okay, new headset. Getting used to it. Can you hear me better?
A little bit, but you're still low.
Okay.
Okay.
I turn the headset even further. How's this?
It doesn't sound like a headset. It sounds like your computer, Are you connecting with a USB port with your headset?
Maybe the headset got disconnected. Hold on.
That's what I'm thinking. It's getting better, but it still sounds...
I'm hearing you through the headset, so you must be hearing me through the headset.
Okay, now that's much better.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
More tech stuff. All right, once upon a time, I was...
I'm hearing grumbles from the control room. They don't think you're close enough to your mic. And I'm sorry, folks, but technology is still in its infancy, even in the 21st century.
Let's see.
Okay. And it's probably a Skype setting, so... If you can go into Skype and kind of look at your settings, make sure that your mic is selected. And I'll tell you what, while Travis is doing that, why don't we go to Dr. Janina Scarlett and see if she has some comments on my setup?
I b- believe I was off the call at the point when you asked the question, if you don't mind repeating that again.
Okay, let me encapsulate one more time. Last night, we had a fascinating revelation that this document, this kind of quasi-fictional, quasi-fact, no one knew, it was kind of like, you know, Schrodinger's cat, that mm-hmm. we have been thinking about for years, the Iron Mountain Report, which was a consideration of all kinds of alternatives to war that would occupy the human race's psyche at the same level of human conflict. It turns out now, because of the debriefings of the president and the declassification of these documents a couple of days ago by the White House, it turns out that the Iron Mountain Report is real. It was a real think tank study in the early 1960s, probably initiated, although we haven't pinned this down totally yet, by the Kennedy administration as a thought experiment. What would mm-hmm. it take to redirect the entire efforts of the human race and the various alternatives, which are in the document at the top of our Other Side of Midnight website tonight? Those recommendations seem to have been quietly, surreptitiously, under the radar of whatever attention span we have, to have over the last 50, 60 years implemented, been quietly implemented. And a lot of the cultural and media frenzies around certain obsessions and certain serialized tentpole films appear to, in fact, be part of this much larger social engineering agenda. And my question was, how did you, as a psychologist, and Travis, as a psychologist, and Dr. Lloyd, and Jaina, as an avid follower of all this material, how did you wind up following what you thought was a fictional set of scenarios in a fictional universe, which now turn out not to maybe be quite so fictional?
Mm-hmm.
And so, please turn down all your devices and phones so we
sure.
don't.
So I work with active duty service members and also veterans with PTSD. So actually my specialty is in working with the military with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Okay.
And the population that I work with tend to have really high affiliation for superheroes, as they highly identify with these fictional characters and want to be like them, want to emulate them, and would like to take on their values. And Captain America, for example, as well as other, certain characters from the DC universe, like Batman, for instance, are also very popular. One of the reasons that I especially got drawn to pop culture and incorporating pop culture into therapy is because of how relevant it seems to be. And now we're learning more and more about how real it might be. And with this revelation especially, I think it's very fascinating and also very relevant to what
And very disturbing.
And very disturbing. It's absolutely frightening.
I mean, all of the things in the Captain America film about, you know, Nazis under different names, yeah. with you know, social experiments, with technology, with secret plan, all of that apparently is now validated as part of programs that are set in motion after the war to actually enslave a lot of human beings into thinking totally different things than normally we would have thought.
It's absolutely frightening. My grandparents are actually Holocaust survivors, and I can definitely relate to what was seen in a lot of these movies. And then it's really frightening to think that something that's very Hydra-like has essentially been going on all these years.
Travis?
Yes.
What are your thoughts? I can hear you fine. Go ahead.
Okay. Of course, you know, I haven't had her kind of experience with, you know, the family having grown up in Europe as she had. Now, of course, backing way up, because before we get to that, you'd asked about how somebody even gets into these kind of things we're doing.
Well, I mean, you all have very impressive resumes in what we would call, before yesterday morning, the real world. Now we're not so sure what the real world is.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, because I was never a big comic books fan when I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
I got into the adult section of the science fiction section of the library, and I was toast. I was lost, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading books that only adults were supposed to read. Remember back then they used to divide it into juveniles and adults?
Oh, yeah.
And I found in the library one day over in the adult section a book by a weird guy with a weird name known as Isaac Asimov. I mean, even his name seemed like alien. And I was totally hooked. So I never went the comic route. I mean, obviously, I paid attention to Superman and Batman and all that. But now we've had this incredible flowering from the mind of Jack Kirby, who again, kind of like Asimov, was a one-man genius at creating these multiple interlocked and overlapping universes that are now, when they're brought to the big screen, I can see, Janina, that a lot of people, a lot of young guys, basically get trapped into that whole mythos of, well, I used to call it the overgrown Boy Scout syndrome.
Yeah, the science fiction connection is important. People often ask us, why in the world are you talking about the psychology of fictional characters, especially the fantastic ones, superheroes, zombies, of course we're not writing about the zombies usually, it's the peoples in those world, and so on.
Guys that can light themselves on fire. And
but science fiction in so many ways has to be truer to real psychology, real politics, than other forms of fiction do. That is why it's Star Trek, you know, in the 60s. It was able to address civil rights issues and so many other political issues that other TV shows were not addressing because we had that filter of fiction taking it outside. And in a lot of ways, you can take a harder look at reality through those sorts of things. And it is repeatedly throughout the entire history on science fiction of any kind, not just the comic books that, you know, we're talking about with the cinematic film. It's looking at reality. It is very much a reflection of what is going on because it has to do with that question of what's possible. And what's possible has a lot to do with where we are now. You know, 'cause it's about where we're going or where could we have gone. And you get into those fantastic questions. They're all on that root of reality. So you go into something like Captain America, into those issues of exactly what is going on with the government. And you can get into it in a fantastic way and have fun with something that could be potentially very scary if somebody were doing a film about somebody rebelling against the CIA, and the CIA creating some very dangerous setups for the entire world. That's a little too close to home to be able to have fun with it, but when Captain America is up against, you know, S.H.I.E.L.D. and HYDRA, we can have fun with it.
Mm. Dr. Lloyd, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I'm looking at your bio, and I'm asking myself, how does a guy who specializes in the psychology of inmates in prisons and rehabilitation and therapy of people who are obviously not fitting into society very well, how did you wind up in the Marvel Universe?
For me, the two have always been sort of separate. To be honest, I work mainly with evaluation of people who've been accused of or convicted of criminal offenses.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, the interest in the Marvel Universe and things like that go back far before any of the interest I had in psychology. I mean, in Captain America especially, I was just thinking about this today. The first superhero comic book I read when I was a kid was Captain America issue 350, which was him coming back after having been fired from his job by the government. And, you know, that was a big part of my childhood. And in a way, it doesn't necessarily feed into my professional work so much, but it's become sort of this necessary thing that I need in my life. When I was in grad school, I was working with sex offenders for a while, listening to them talk about, when it comes right down to it, some of the pretty horrible things that they'd done to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I find myself needing to go back to sort of this universe that had been such an important part of my childhood to kind of cope with some of the things that I was hearing now as an adult. So it doesn't necessarily feed into the work that I do so much, though I certainly have had clients back in the days when I was doing more therapy who were familiar with this universe as well, and it sort of helped to kind of form sort of more rapport with them.
In dealing, predominantly, obviously, you are dealing with men, right?
Predominantly, yes.
Okay. Do you find that these misfits in society have similar patterns of trying to pattern their lives after the exceptionalism they saw in these superhero films or comic books or whatever? In other words, are they failed examples of the people that Janina is working with who are not failed examples?
I don't know that I've ever thought about it quite that way before. I don't know that I get a lot of sense that many of the people that I'm working with are at least consciously trying to pattern themselves after the things that we see in these universes. Most often, the people that I work with have sort of broken with reality entirely, not just, you know, the reality as we know it, but any kind of reality. And the way that they think about things wouldn't make any more sense to the people that write these comic books that they do than they do to us.
Okay, let me bring Jenna Bush here. Jenna, you are representative of all the rest of us who are not experts, who are not psychologists, who are not looking at this in an analytical sense, except, you know, as fans look at things in an analytical sense. You're the founder and editor-in-chief of the Legion of Leah. We'll probably have to ask about that. And you've hosted and written for sites like IGN, AOL, Huffington Post. You've co-hosted something called Cocktails with Stan. Which is the legendary Stan Lee. How has this universe manifested itself in your life and brought you to the other side of midnight tonight?
Well, you'll laugh, but the way I got into comics was someone told me about Storm from X-Men. And when I was a kid, I lived in New York, and I really wanted a snow day. And I thought if I were Storm, I could totally give me a snow day. So that's actually how I got into it. You know, it's interesting. One of the things you were talking about before in terms of misdirection from the government, it's funny. As you were talking, I was thinking that's something that's been around for a really long time. It isn't something that's new. I mean, if you looked at the way medieval churches were built and the fear that was carved into demon statues, and that was the way that the populace learned about religion. And I think that's something that's always sort of been done. But one of the other things you were talking about in terms of sci-fi, and something Travis was talking about being able to use these characters as a way to talk about things that make us uncomfortable. And I think that's something that I think in terms of if you're looking at something like Captain America and you're looking at something like Hydra and you're talking about Nazis and you're talking about secret societies and all of these things that, you know, you could see on Facebook now. You could look at any political discussion now and talk about them and you might sound a little out there. But if you still have this sort of sinking feeling about it, it's really easy to have a dialogue about it if you're talking about a fictional character.
Mm. So it really is a kind of a misdirection way of getting at the truth without really getting at the truth.
I think so, and I think sci-fi is usually the place where you find the most acceptance early on. You look at gay characters, trans characters. You use aliens to be placeholders for things that make you uncomfortable. And you can have a dialogue about things that you wouldn't normally talk about, or you might feel like you were being offensive, or you might feel like you were asking the wrong questions if you were talking about reality, but you can use it to sort of soften what you're saying.
Okay. I'll tell you what, everybody hold it there. We have a break now at the bottom of the hour. I'm talking with four remarkably intriguing guests this morning, Dr. Travis Langley, Jana Bush, Dr. Janina Scarlett, and Dr. Martin Lloyd. And we're basically talking about the transition from fiction to fact and back to fiction, because from Iron Mountain we find out there may be no real difference at all. And we're back. You're on the other side of midnight. My guests this morning, Travis Langley, Jana Bush, Janina Scarlett, and Martin Lloyd, and I are discussing the Marvel Universe tentpole films and the captivation of our culture, our society, by a fictional reality that, according to the White House in the last 48 hours, may not be quite as fictional as we all have thought. Let me throw out this, guys, and whoever wants to pick it up, please join in. I wonder, I mean, we've had comics all my life, all your lives. Comic books have been everywhere. You know, people have been collecting comics. The early comics are incredibly valuable. Unless, of course, as someone I know, had her mother throw all her valuable comics out, in which case now she is in therapy because she's looking. You know where I'm going. Anyway.
It's because of that the rest of them are so valuable.
I want to know, at what point did we transition from, you know, Casablanca and Gone with the Wind and How Green is My Valley to Captain America, the Civil War? What transitioned our culture to where we're now willing to suspend disbelief, because most people don't realize this stuff might be actually true at some level, to suspend disbelief willingly, to catapult ourselves into a totally fictional realm, you know, with gods like Thor and, you know, guys like Tony Stark, although he does remind me a lot of Elon Musk. How did we make this transition from good literature brought to the screen to good comic books brought to the screen that have multiple levels that no one except us this morning and folks listening even begin to suspect?
Well, you all want to go. CGI helps.
All right.
Oh, yeah.
Take a number.
Jaina? I think it was partially Star Wars. Obviously,
So you're going to blame George Lucas. Okay.
Oh, no, I wouldn't blame. I love this stuff.
I'm being facetious. Come on.
I know. No, but I think it was partially Star Wars, because we obviously had wonderful science fiction before this, but we didn't have the
What about my favorite, 2001?
Oh, of course. I mean, look, there are definitely things before, but that was a cultural zeitgeist. I mean, that changed everything. I actually just heard my father say the other day that when he went to see that, it blew his mind. He'd never seen anything like it. And that was really when I was a little kid when that came out. But I think that changed it in terms of public consciousness, because it was something that everyone could get behind. I mean, you're seeing the same thing right now with the seventh film coming out. Everyone, I mean, adults, children, everyone all over the world is excited about this. And I think that's
I'm sorry to interrupt. I was going to say, I think there's more anticipation of that film than there is of the Pope's visit.
Oh, absolutely. I am way more excited for Star Wars. But I think that really changed everything. And I think that once you have a hook in people like that with science fiction, with fantasy, I think it was really a short hop to comics. I mean, you have somebody like Michael Uslan, who bought the rights to Batman when no one really cared about it after the show, and it was sort of a joke, and he's the reason that we have Batman. And then you have everyone
getting... Wait.
You
mean the TV show?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, Michael is why we have the movies.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's because nobody was interested after the TV show.
Well, I remember watching the TV show, and I was very, very unhappy with the TV show. You know why? Because it made fun of one of the few comics that I kind of was intrigued with, and I wanted to see more serious plots, more serious action. In other words, that TV series always left me like, good grief, what in the world did I just waste half an hour of my life that'll never come back watching that?
Well, that was exactly Michael Uslan's reaction. That was the primary reason why he wanted to go into movies and make a serious Batman film
folks that don't know who Michael is, give a little background.
Michael Uslan, when he was a student, was the first person to teach a college class, a accredited college course on comics as folklore. He went on to get a law degree and produce the Batman movies. Took him 10 years to fight to get the first Batman film made, because nobody wanted to do anything with Batman.
And what ultimately drove him to do that was because he was so mortified and disappointed with the 60s TV show.
Interesting.
Because it was one of his favorite, it was his absolute favorite comic book character, someone he really identified with.
Because
the TV show made him so unrealistic and, as you said, almost poked fun at this character. It made him so upset that he wanted to do Batman justice.
Well,
and I think
my reaction was coming off the Superman serials.
Mm-hmm.
Because Superman in film and in television, you know, with George Reeve and you know, mm-hmm. other successors, always seemed to deal with that universe very seriously, not tongue-in-cheek. It basically played fair with its audience, its young audience, its young male audience, whereas the Batman serial always seemed to me to be almost like, oh, you guys are nuts to believe any of this stuff.
Well, I think a lot changed toward more people using comics as more of a reflection of real life once Comic Code Authority stopped controlling everything that went into comics. So,
can you kind of go into the background? Because that was kind of like the sure. Legion of Decency or the... I'm thinking of other panels and triumvirates that have tried to censor what we see in here.
Yes, so there was a psychiatrist that released a report.
What year?
1954.
Oh my God!
1954. He released a report stating that comic books were essentially brainwashing children, and that they were dangerous for children. So his name was Frederick Wortham, and he falsified his data, and he basically stated that. For example, that Batman and Robin were gay, and that this was a really bad example for the youth, and that youth that were going to be reading these comics were going to become violent. And
now, where did this come from? Out of nowhere? Just he suddenly decided one day to take on the comics?
Okay, let me take this one. After World War II, people were trying to understand the increase in juvenile delinquency. In England... they developed attachment theory, explaining it in terms of how family life had been disrupted, connections to parents, and so you saw this increase, this change of what was going on in the youth over there. Over in America, after World War II, when comic book sales were going down, because a lot of comics were going to soldiers, the comic book sales were going down, a psychologist who created Wonder Woman died right before Frederick Wortham burst onto the scene talking about how comic books were causing juvenile delinquency. There's always been a scapegoat. It can be rock music, rap music, the movies. At that particular point, the scapegoat was comic books. Wortham wrote this book about how comic books were causing juvenile delinquency. He testified before the Senate on that, and he had this book, Seduction of the Innocent, about how comic books were causing juvenile delinquency in America.
And here I thought it was Elvis Presley.
And so it was that same year that the Comic Code Authority was established, and they had all of these very stringent rules that good always had to defeat the evil, and authority figures always had to be good, and there couldn't be certain representations. For example, there couldn't be any homosexuality, no vampires, no witches, no zombies. It was very, very strict and quite unrealistic representation of life. And it was toward, Travis, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was toward the 1980s that they started kind of loosening up a little bit. And now we start to have more of the gritty comics that represent more of the real life events that have characters going through trauma and through more severe life events, and we're also seeing more heroic deaths, and the good does not always win. And I think that's where people are starting to get more interested, because it represents more of real life and more of the pain and suffering that we humans go through that we can really relate in fictional characters as
so
well.
The superheroes are really humans with abilities, but they're humans. Kind of like the Greek gods were humans, superhumans, with human frailties, but powers.
Right. In fact, a lot of times the current comic book characters are referred to as the modern myth. Whether it's in DC world, Batman and Superman, or in Marvel world, the X-Men or Captain America or Iron Man, they are considered now modern mythology.
And it's very similar to Greek mythology in that the gods are fallible. They have just as many issues as we do. They just have more power than we do.
Right.
And, you know, it's very interesting because I was a guest on a Chinese talk show not that long ago.
Wait, you were a guest on a Chinese talk show?
I was, yes. It was a show about Stan Lee. And one of the things that one of the Chinese professors on the show was talking about was that they're just now accepting a lot of our superhero movies, but they have to be heavily censored, and that in China they don't have a lot of superheroes, because very often with superheroes, the way we think of them, they're very apt to challenge authority. And in China, that's not really something that they're very happy with. So they generally tend to stick with more mythology. And in the mythology in China, you see less of that. It's less of the superhero Greek god.
Although in China, they do have superheroes like Chang, you know, the goddess of the moon.
Mm-hmm. But that's mythology.
Is it mythology or is it, we won't argue the point.
It's not a modern creation.
No, it's not. But it seems to me that by identifying that goddess and that mythology in their space program and sending robots to the moon that are so cute and cuddly in personification of her pet rabbit, you know, Jade Rabbit, they have brought forward a mythology that's thousands of years old, whereas our mythologies, you know, Captain America is what, 50, 60, something like that.
I think it still taps into the same thing.
That's where I was going.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing there is that they just don't, the challenging of authority, and that's something that changed.
Well, she was banished to the moon for challenging authority.
Well, yeah, but different kind of authority. We're talking about cops and government, that kind of authority. And I think that's something that we saw more after the Comics Code was dropped.
Who's the guy on our panel or the gal who knows about Jack Kirby?
Probably Travis.
We all need to know plenty about Jack.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, Jack Kirby was one of
hang on.
Creator. Okay.
Travis, let me ask the question, because the question I'm going to ask you has nothing to do with anything you've ever been asked before.
Oh, cool.
I guarantee you. Everybody's in front of the computer, so I want you to go to othersideofmidnight.com, go to the guest page tonight. That's a double hop. Remember, you go to the page, and then you click on the guest. That takes you to the tonight's page. If you scroll down past all the exquisite illustrations that Rich Roland and Keith Roland and Ross Campbell, our producer, have put together for this show tonight, scroll down to a comic which says The Face on Mars. Now, this was written and penned in 1958 as part of, I guess, an anthology comic. There were a couple of stories sandwiched in one book. The really remarkable, incredible thing is, of course, in 1976, NASA flew a spacecraft called Viking to Mars. It looked down, it photographed a structure on the Martian surface, which turns out to be the face on Mars, emblematic of an incredible ancient extraterrestrial civilization. And my question is, how did Jack Kirby know decades before it was found it was there?
Well, Jack Kirby invented space, you see.
Of course.
No, Jack Kirby was doing 2001 type art before 2001. Of course, that's why he did the 2001 comic for Marvel.
No, actually, that was just after 2001.
It's I'm saying he was doing these kind of things before they showed up, before people knew about them. He was a man with an intriguing style, and of course. We think about these fantastic things, and Kirby was so interested in things like ancient, you know, the Easter Island statues, and he was intrigued by ancient art and sculpture, and so it does seem like a rather natural sort of thing for him to think of.
A giant mile-long hollow face on Mars where his astronauts entered the face, fell into another reality, got basically taught by some ancient technological device. Somebody does not have their mic muted when they're not on the air. And we see in this comic book a reflection of what 30 years of independent research has now brought to verification, that there was this incredible ancient civilization, not only on Mars, but all over the solar system, Pluto being a stunning example of where the research has now gone, because those things on the surface of Pluto, those aren't mountains. Those are huge, domed, ancient glass cities covered with nitrogen and carbon dioxide snow because it's so cold out there. And that story has yet to be told. But someone like a Kirby who could limb out these incredible possibilities, and then decades later we find out that more and more is true, who was Jack Kirby really and what was he plugged into?
I just think he had a fantastic imagination. You know, I've read a lot of sci-fi and a lot of fantasy, and you find that themes are very similar if you read enough of it, and I just think he had a great imagination.
Okay, let me stop you there, because we've got three psychologists on the panel this morning. Let me run up the flagpole another possible idea, which I've thought more and more of as more and more of my friends, you know, in the sci-fi world, people that I knew who wrote extraordinary classic science fiction and set the tone for an entire field, people like Heinlein and Clark and Asimov and Pohl and many others. I began to wonder many, many years ago if science fiction writers, and you can now transfer that to the writers of these films and the writers of the comics, if all of these people who are living out fantastic, amazing worlds don't in fact have amazing imaginations, what they do have is a conduit to some source of information. And you can look at various modalities for how that could come about. There's the Akashic Record folks, you know, if you're looking at Far Eastern mythologies and religions. But, or you can look at the reincarnative model that, you know, we have multiple lives, and some of us are able to connect those lives together and kind of peer back through time mentally somehow, and we bring forward, and then we project as fiction, in fact, things that we, a very long time ago, experienced as reality, and that's why these individuals shine like beacons, and their imaginations seem so incredible, because, in fact, they are going back to a source of actual information. Thoughts? Anybody?
Well, of course, some of that's falling outside of the realm of things that we can put to the test in any way.
So, why do you say that's not possible? Why could we not test that?
Well, how am I going to? I can't do an experiment on the people who were here thousands of years ago. So it gets in that realm of things we would have trouble putting to the test. You know, but that doesn't mean that inherently mean it's right or wrong. The testability, you know, things we focus on with what we view as empirical science and psychology. Psychology, more than any other science, because of it being the soft science, the one that looks at more abstract concepts, you'll not find a more self-critical area where people worry more about, you know, what people are seeing with the science. And how would you put, like, thousands of years ago, things that were going on with the culture, going on with, you know, ancient ancestors, you know, we can't ask them what they were experiencing. But you're familiar with the works of Carl Jung?
Yeah, of course.
Now, Carl Jung, who is a psychiatrist who was a contemporary of Freud's, and over, you know, the course of a few years, he and Freud had a big falling out, as a lot of people did with Freud. And Jung looked at these themes that appear all over the world. These themes you'll find in every single culture. And he looked at that and felt that people all over the world are being shaped by something that is, you know, ingrained, inherited somehow. And you see these themes emerge. The hero's journey that Joseph Campbell came to talk about grew out of Jung's work.
And George Lucas's Star Wars, you know, umpteen serials grew out of Joseph Campbell's conversations with Lucas.
Yeah, Lucas did it very deliberately. He was having trouble finishing his original Star Wars story until he discovered those works. He's like, oh, this is the story I'm telling. So,
didn't Campbell live kind of next door down the beach or something?
Yeah, they became friends.
So, all right, that's the archetypal model. What I'm proposing is an alternative model, which is there are some people, I mean, we're all, in this model, we're all antennas. We all resonate with the ether, the background torsion field, whatever you want to call it. And there's actually, Travis, there's experimental data that human consciousness can actually be picked up by instrumentality and measured when it's doing this linkage, this connection. But that's a whole other program, and maybe we'll have you back to talk about that, and you can talk about some of that data. My point is that if reincarnation is true, and we do lead multiple serial lives, are there some of us who are, for whatever reason, genetics maybe, who are attuned to where we can remember the ghostly outlines of the lives we used to lead, and we're so impelled because of the dissonance with our current reality that we turn to expressing it, writing it down? I mean, I know many people who have these extraordinary fights in their minds with people, and they write letters or emails, and they never send them. just the very act of getting it out on the screen or getting it out on paper was enough of the therapy that they needed that they could move on. Is it possible that the great sci-fi writers and people like Stan Lee and people like Jack Kirby somehow are attuned to other realities where the phantasmagorical things they wrote and depicted, in fact, were reality?
Well, you've already started off with a lot of ifs there to begin with.
Of course.
Given all those ifs...
You're on the other side of midnight.
It's like, yeah, once we're given all those ifs, then yes, definitely. It's like, you know, if there are these things, you know, if there is, you know, the telepathic conduit, if there is the reincarnation, then logically, as an extension of that, some of these people who are giving us these fantastic stories, you know, could be tapping into that. And I do think, well, it's like, you know, I'm going to know the archetypal things. Where I think it's the same kind of thing as being influenced by the archetypes, though. I think they can go together. You don't know the source of some of your own things. You're being influenced by things you don't realize.
Have you ever
in everyday life?
Have you ever,
things.
Travis? Have you ever written something and you had the feeling? I mean, I'm right. I'm a professional writer. That's what I do. That's one of the things I do. Have you ever had the feeling when you're writing something that you're not writing, you're kind of taking down dictation, that something else is going on, that there's an automatic process where it has to come out a certain way because that's the way it did come out?
Well, I don't know about it being that it did come out, but there's definitely, you get in a rhythm and you don't know, you know, where these things are going. It's coming out of you. Yeah, I tend to think of it as being, you know, the nonverbal unconscious part of me that's pulling these together.
Mm-hmm. But that, of course, assumes you're an island and you're not connected to anybody else through the ether.
That does, and that is... That's what I tend to focus on. Well, it's not assuming those other things don't exist, but it is definitely viewing it as an influence, and that tends to be where I think about these things, because that is within me, and
see, I would
that is
really
what I control.
I would really like to know, because I was really good friends with Arthur C. Clarke, most amazing friendship you can imagine, and when he moved back to Sri Lanka and I was in Southern Virginia, just beginning to look at the Cydonia, you know, ancient civilizations on Mars, the face on Mars, what could have happened, and then building the model to include it was more than just Mars, it was other parts of the solar system, and ultimately it was a huge, extensive Type 2 civilization a la Kardashev and Sagan and, I forget the modern guy. Anyway, I was having exchanges with Arthur via email on the concept of Cydonia. Cydonia is this place on Mars where the face on Mars was located by NASA. Arthur was a very mild-mannered person. He kind of reminded me of Clark Kent in the Clark Kent persona, even down to the glasses. I never saw him angry. I never saw him ruffle. I never saw him disagreeable. I never saw him not genteel with people. He loved to talk about himself, but then there was a lot there to talk about. But in our exchanges on Cydonia, for the first time, Arthur got actually angry with me for even bringing up the possibility that an ancient civilization on Mars could be real anger. And I got thinking, you know, years later or a couple of years later, because it was the kind of anger which had a visceral, emotional connection. In other words, he really was unhappy that I was trying to discuss something which he kept dismissing as, oh, that's nonsense, that's crazy, come on, that can't possibly, you know. In other words, it's back to Shakespeare. I thought he protested a bit too much. And then I got to thinking, is it possible that he himself is doubting in his older years, as he looks back and has all the experiences and we find more stuff? Is he beginning to wonder where his wellspring of incredible creativity actually stemmed from? And that's why he's angry. He's not angry at the idea of a civilization on Cydonia. He's angry at the idea that maybe what he's writing is not coming from within. It's coming from somewhere else.
Well, self-doubt can be a powerful thing, of course. But from what I know of Clark, obviously you knew him far better than most. But, you know, he was a man who was, you know, very invested in what he saw as rational thinking, and would get very frustrated by having to have some of the same discussions over and over. And so some of that could also be that built-up frustration over coming back to that topic yet again, just worn out by it.
Well, I don't think it was coming back because I was the first guy to broach it with him.
Well, that specific one, yeah. But in terms
and
of
and we have data. Remember, elements. We were discussing evidence, data, you know, imagery, angles, geometry, scattering functions, you know, Sagan's great precept, you know, intelligent life on Earth first manifests itself in the geometric regularity of constructions. Well, part of our conversation was, how do you tell, looking down on remote sensing instruments and remote sensing imagery, that somebody once was alive down there? How do you look at the bones, the remnants, the ghostly remains of an ancient civilization? And he got so upset with even the topic, my alarm bells went ding, ding, ding. Have I tripped over something really interesting here? And there's deafening silence from our panel.
Well, we didn't know him.
On that note, we have a break, so everybody stay where you are. We shall be back. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. As we barrel into the night in the land of enchantment, on the other side, sometimes, of reality itself, we'll be right back. And we're back. The other side of midnight with my guests this morning, Travis Langley, Jana Bush, Janina Scarlett, and Dr. Martin Lloyd. Martin, you've been very quiet over there. I infer from what you said before that you don't actively use any of this fictional material in your work with the prison population, but you think of it almost as a kind of a refuge, a place to go back to pleasanter and more interesting times. Martin? Hello? Are we having technical problems again? Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Okay. Let me see. We probably have to go to the studio and have them put on something while I try to get everybody back. This is very ups. They all appear to be gone. I don't see.
I'm here.
Oh, there you are. Okay.
Can you hear me?
Okay, I'm hearing Martin. Did you hear my question? Hello, Martin. Okay, Janina has rejoined us again. Okay, let me switch questions then, because I don't see whether Lloyd should be there, but he's not. Okay, Jana, you became a kind of a professional fan, a professional nerd about all this. How did just an interest in these realities, these fictional stories, turn into a kind of, I guess, a full-time job for you?
Well, I've always loved it. I got into this thing very early. I got into it through Anne McCaffrey and the Dragon Rider series.
Oh, of course, of course. Dragon Riders of Pern.
Yeah, that was my entrance into all of this. And I was an actor for years. I was a makeup artist for years. And then a friend of mine from high school knew what a geek I was and asked me to start writing for him. And I've been writing my entire life. So I started covering this, and I am such a geek that I cover video games, comics, TV, film, and I love doing it, and someone is letting me talk about what I love and paying me for it. So it's hard not to turn that into a career if someone hands that to you. But, I mean, I guess professional fan's the way to put it, but really it's sort of turned into more commentary on the state of fandom as well as just reporting news, talking about women in geekdom and that sort of thing. So, It's pretty much all consuming.
So if I were to ask you what your favorite stories or favorite comics were or favorite films, how would you respond? Do you have like a pattern, or are you just interested?
Oh yeah.
Okay, well let's go with that.
Yeah, I mean there's definitely a wide range. Anne McCaffrey's always going to be top of the list for me because that is how I started. And
now,
I actually
Anne was, I think, one of the few female science fiction writers in history, if I'm not mistaken.
Back then, yeah. Back then. I mean, now there's plenty. But yeah, back then, absolutely. She was one of the few, and she had some amazing stories with some incredible female characters. And when you start reading these things at seven, I was reading things that they were way too old for me when I was seven. But
see, I was a fan of Andre Norton.
I love Andre Norton as well, but Anne McCaffrey, I got into it through a smaller series of hers, Dragon Singer, Dragon Song, and so it was happening at the same time as the Dragon Rider series, but it was a young girl that was the lead character. So that definitely, in terms of books, I also read a lot of history and nonfiction, but movies, Star Wars was my way in, absolutely. I love Star Wars and Star Trek. So, I mean, I guess, and video games were a really big thing for me, too, because it was an ongoing story. You know, when I read Anne McCaffrey, she had so many books that you could be all consumed for months and months and months. And that's the same thing with video games.
Did she write The Ship Who Sang?
She did.
Oh,
she did.
Tell everybody what that is, because that to me was such an extraordinary revelation, which Gene Roddenberry then picked up in Star Trek, kind of, but not really.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So in her future, if a child was born and was not in perfect form, or there was something hereditarily wrong with them where their body was no longer going to function and there was nothing they could do about it, they would take the consciousness of this child and put it into a ship.
A spaceship, yeah.
And so they were this person was conscious of the entire ship, ran it, functioned instead of bodily functions, you'd have ship functions, and you were partnered with a person. So it was called a brain and brawn, and that was the combination. So very often this would be a lifetime partnership. So I found those absolutely fascinating.
Well, the thing that I got off on was the idea of a technological device that actually had consciousness, that you could interact with, that you could be friends with, that you could, you know, tell your troubles to or cry on or, you know, whatever. That to me, again, it was unprecedented in anything I'd read up until that point, and it was a woman writer who did it.
Yeah, and it was a very interesting way of approaching AI because, you know, if you look at the way they approach data in Star Trek The Next Generation or even something up to Ex Machina, which is a very recent movie, which was fascinating about
haven't seen it yet.
Oh my God, you have to see it. It's so good. But it's a really interesting discussion about at what point you go from machine that knows how to function and knows how to respond to you to something that's thinking on its own. And is it the machine function that's thinking, or are you having emotions and feelings? Her, the year before, was another film that explored that. But this was a really interesting way into AI because it wasn't really AI. I mean, this was an actual consciousness that it's, you know, in a way it's like having mechanical limbs, but
The idea of having basically a human being as with the body of a ship, the idea is born then, the consciousness prevails, and the various vehicles that we wear, we're going back to the reincarnation model, folks, are just transient, but consciousness is the continuity. Then when we get to Kubrick, we have an artificial intelligence, HAL, runs the ship, is omnipresent, you know, everywhere, etc., and then he goes mad. So there was this real dichotomy between these two views of a consciousness in a vehicle keeping its human partners alive. One would try everything to keep them alive, and the other felt that they were kind of superfluous to the mission, that the mission was all critical. And it comes back, it turns out, in the film and in Arthur's novel, all to the terrible secret. Secrecy was to prevail. Hal was instructed to even kill the crew if the secret of what they were really out there to do ever became known, which I think is a metaphor for a lot more going on than was understood back in the year of 2001.
I mean, I think that's something that is it's a really very interesting way to explore government secrets or I mean even personal secrets. But I think in terms of Anne McCaffrey's universe, you know, you're really not dealing with AI. It's an interesting way to look at AI, but you are still dealing with a person with human failings and human loves and human feelings. Maybe not physical feelings in the same way, but still a human consciousness.
Mm. Travis, you're being very quiet over there.
I don't know if I can be heard.
You can be heard.
Oh, I can.
Yes.
Okay, good. Because it keeps telling me call fail, so Skype is telling me that I'm not here.
Skype is well, obviously they're out to get us tonight because Skype has never done this in the entire couple of 3 months I've been doing the show. I've had the worst problems with Skype tonight. So obviously the folks behind Iron Mountain are not happy about this conversation.
That's clearly what it is.
Or it's like you just don't know how to use Skype right.
It's kind of mechanical. So let me ask you. You do these addresses at various conventions like Comic-Con. I mean, I was actually invited to address Comic-Con 1 year, and something else came up, and I had to actually decline. When I've really been very unhappy about that, and I would love to be invited back. Because all the stuff that I'm talking about in fiction, like, you know, what Kirby was predicting, now we're looking at real data, and I could present one hell of a picture that a lot of the fiction folks think is fiction, maybe not. So
I think you would draw a good crowd too.
You do. So when you do these presentations, what do you talk about? What's your spiel?
Oh gosh, a lot of different things, but the most common thing is to use the fictional characters to talk about real psychology.
Okay.
So when I go in there talking about, you know, the symptoms of PTSD that you'll see with Batman or the Walking Dead characters, and I use that to also to talk about how PTSD isn't quite what people commonly think it is, and I love talking about something called post-traumatic growth, how some people with some symptoms of that grow as people, find their purpose in life. And so in analyzing these characters, which sounds very frivolous to a lot of people, it's like, you're just talking about fictional characters. Yeah, but I'm using it to talk about how real people think and how real people act. So that's the most common thing I do. I do a lot of convention panels. I checked my CV. I've got over 400 panels I've been involved in over the years.
Mm.
So there's also just comics history and things is generally interest in this. But I meet interesting people. Jenna and Janina, I first met in person at conventions. Marty came up to my table at a convention. We had a conversation. I was like, hey, want to join me on a panel talking about the psychology of supervillains? And so with those fantastic villains, we again talk about the real psychology of what we know about real people and what is or is not realistic in the characters. So that's the main thing I do at these conventions.
Ian Fleming, of course, is a totally separate discussion, the Bond films and all that, but there's an incredibly interesting crossover to me between the supervillains that were portrayed in Ian Fleming's work and the supervillains like, you know, Lex Luthor and others that were coming out of the comics. Do you think that Fleming was at all influenced by the comic world, the comic universe?
I know he influenced the comics very much.
And how did that work?
Actually, very successfully. There's one particular Batman villain who's really important, Ra's al Ghul or Ra's al Ghul, depending on how well you know him, who was basically created to bring a Bond villain into Batman. And
Consciously,
you know, Danny O'Neill and his editors, it's like, we want a Bond villain in Batman.
Okay.
And that is an incredibly important character. He's not the one quite as outlandish. He doesn't have the green hair. He doesn't look like a penguin. He has this international quality that brought Batman out of Gotham. Before that, for a while, Batman had been more likely to go into outer space than to leave town. And Batman then was roaming the Earth. Like in Batman Begins, he's roaming the Earth when he first encounters Al Ghul. But in the comics, Al Ghul was part of making Batman part of a bigger, more realistic world. So oddly enough, the Bond villain made Batman more part of the real world.
Hmm. You're saying Al Ghul. I'm thinking of the Ghoul in Stargate, kind of like the inverse.
I think there's some similarity in the origins of those worlds.
That's what I'm wondering. Yeah,
I think it's a very conscious decision, especially with the Stargate folks. Mm-hmm. With Al Ghul, they were looking for what would be a translation of what they thought would translate to the demon as part of the name. So I know with that one, it was deliberate, and I think it was with Stargate, too. They wanted to evoke that sense, because, you know, the word ghoul itself, you know, has a strong connotation to people in many different languages.
Okay, in our work, you know, we're looking at this whole hyperdimensional torsion field model, and the torsion field is the ether, and we've got instruments that can actually measure changes, you know, tremors in the force, to use a Lukeism. I'm wondering, because part of that model is that as this physics changes, it's kind of modulated in the background, and when it changes, human consciousness changes with it. One of the things that I've been noticing and kind of epitomized in a kind of a slang phrase is that the good are getting better and the bad are getting worse. And we see this in politics, we see it in media, we see it in real life, we see it in mass shootings, we see it in, you know, the incredible, awful refugee crisis now going on in the Middle East. There are these increasing polarities where there isn't much in the middle, but you have these extremes, like almost like frequency extremes, if you're talking about electromagnetic waves or something like that. As part of that model, as part of that entry point, I would like to know, if you guys can tell me, I've got three psychologists now to ask, what the heck is going on with all the obsession with zombies and Walking Dead? What is that all about?
I have answered so many versions of this question.
But I want the real answer, Travis. Come on.
Okay. This day and age, okay, we live in a world where so many people around you are acting like zombies, where someone can be so caught up in their phone they walk up to the fountain and fall into the water in the mall just like something out of Dawn of the Dead.
I've actually seen that video several million times.
We're living in the world where those things happen, where there's this zombie-like quality, and there's this fear of losing our humanity. And that zombie is the ultimate loss of the humanity, where your body's there, but whoever, whatever is you is not.
But if this is fear, why is there this incredible fascination? Because I know people that, you know, binge watch the series, they stay home, they don't see anybody, they just endlessly watch really ghoulish stuff. And I'm wondering, where is that coming from? Is that ultimate escapism?
I think, oddly enough, it goes back to that value in science fiction itself, and it's odd way it lets you look at some of the darkest aspects of the real world, real humanity. Like in The Walking Dead, you've got these characters, but you're wondering, it's like, what does it take for them to hang on to who they are? Who will become bad? Who will maintain, you know, the sense of who they really are? We're in this 21st century world. I don't think it's a coincidence that one third of all zombie movies have come out since 9/11, you know, changed people's concerns about the world. Max Brooks, creator of World War Z, you know, he gets asked about this. And he said, you know, with zombies, you know it's not real. And so you can look at your very real fear of what if there's an apocalypse, or what if people turn on each other. And if you're watching, you know, a film that's too close to reality, it's hard for you to go to sleep. You watch it with zombies, okay, you know that's not real. Even as you're looking at these things, people turning on each other.
Remember the rumor that went whipping around the internet a few years ago about the zombie apocalypse is coming?
I remember that.
And where did that come from, and who was behind it, and was it part of this Iron Mountain meme that we have to drive everybody so far into fear porn that they'll do anything we say?
Well, Brooks, he looks at political history as well himself. But in his view, it was that there was no way that was real, and to the majority of the population. So we're talking about the interest, the popular interest, and for most people, they accept that that's not real. Even though people will argue about it. There was a case a few years ago, this guy who ended up in such a heated argument with his girlfriend over whether zombies could be real, he shot her. So you see doomsday preppers. You see people who are concerned about where things could go.
Right.
And they may not even know what doomsday they're preparing for, but they're worried something could happen. And that is in the we got this crowded planet full of, you know, 7 billion people, how rapidly that has gone from having been 4 billion when I was a kid, for over a century since the 1 billion before that.
Yeah.
This crowded planet with you wonder about how limited are the resources, how abundant are there, and people worry about these things. And
well, the obvious answer to that is we can't remain confined to one planet. We've got to use the resources of the solar system, and yet no one, no serious policy person in the 21st century is actually proposing that, except a few people like Elon Musk. Janina, you were trying to get in before, and I could hear flickering thoughts. So please come forward and tell me why is there this obsession with dead people walking around and going to libraries or eating in cafes or
To me, it kind of seems like when there isn't hope, when the world just seems...
Did we lose Janina?
It sounds like
it. Oh, this is weird. The Skype stuff tonight is really weird, folks. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Okay, while we try to get Janina back, it says call dropped. Okay, let me try to reinstate. So, Travis, why don't you fill in while I'm getting her back, okay?
Okay. We're on the... I was listening to Janina. I wanted to hear the rest of what she had to say.
I know. Well.
Hello?
Janina, you're back. Okay,
yay.
Good. Okay.
Okay. So, to me, it kind of seems like when people are going through a hard time, in some ways, imagining a zombie apocalypse is, in a fictional way, imagining the worst possible thing that could happen and then fighting for hope. So I think when people are ready to give up, fighting for hope, fighting for resources, finding a way to connect with other people might be the very thing that they need. So, for example, when there was that terrible tragedy in Sri Lanka a few years ago, what ultimately ended up helping people prevent developing PTSD was when people were able to come together and rebuild together. Pulling the resources together, connecting with other people, social connection, all of these have actually been shown through research to be a factor in ensuring post-traumatic growth, which Travis already talked about. So I think in some ways, zombie apocalypse is a fictional depiction of that, of the worst possible catastrophe that could happen, or might not happen, most likely won't happen. But it is something that maybe, to some extent, can show us what is it that we're fighting for and what are some of the ways we can connect with other people and figure out what's really important to us when things like money and other things don't matter as much. And what are the most important things in our life?
You know, the thing that I see in those films, and I don't watch a lot of them, I see them occasionally on TV and it's kind of click over and there's a particularly intriguing scene and you get caught and then you get caught up and then you watch a little. The thing I notice is that it's basically us versus them. The
right.
Them are all the bad dead people who are walking around and wanting to kill and maim and do all kinds of things that you wonder, why would dead people really care about any of that anymore?
Of course, that's not really the them. It is a lot of us versus them, but the dead people in The Walking Dead and these other stories, it's repeatedly emphasized that they're not the real threat. Your fellow human beings
who
are
might
the greater danger.
Masquerading as dead people.
Well,
you know, the enemy within. But the other part of my comparison was, then you have humans, regardless of race, creed, religion, money, status, whatever, they all band together as a community to solve
right.
the problem together. So it's a reason to drop all the other false pretensions and just deal with each other as humans in need of each other to survive.
Well, I think you saw that a lot after 9/11. I was in New York when that happened, and everyone was really, really nice to each other for a very short amount of time. I'm not a psychologist, but I also think that
but Jenna, that's why you're on the panel, because you're not a psychologist.
Well, this is something, and Travis and Janina can tell me, if this is right. But you know, I think when you're at 9/11, just thinking about that made me think of this. I had a very good friend who lost someone, and she kept saying, "How is everyone going on when I'm going through this? Why are people going back to work?" And I think when you're going through something, and the rest of the world is continuing on, you can't say, "Oh my God, everyone stop and tell and fix this for me." So when you sort of escape into fiction, and especially fiction where you're fighting off monsters or there's a global threat and everyone is facing the same thing, I think it makes you feel a sense of camaraderie, a sense that you're not alone and that other people understand, because everyone can see exactly how awful this feels to you in some way.
Okay. Travis?
Right. And there's something... Oh, go ahead.
Janina, I'm sorry.
I think there's something about what Jenna was just saying. When we experience a loss, it's almost like there is an apocalypse happening. And when we feel alienated, that is actually one of the bigger triggers for developing a mental health disorder. For example, for PTSD, avoidance of social connection is the biggest risk factor for developing PTSD, whereas social connection is one of the biggest reasons why people might overcome a mental health disorder or develop post-traumatic growth. And so I think when we're watching these films, when we're experiencing a connection with a fictional character that might be suffering in a parallel way, maybe another fictional character that has lost somebody, even if we don't have someone in real life that has experienced the same loss we have, that alone might, for at least for some people, promote that kind of healing and recovery that we otherwise would when we're connecting with actual people in real life that have experienced the same thing.
Yeah, when we did the book, The Walking Dead Psychology, Psych of the Living Dead, the foreword by John Russo, co-creator of Night of the Living Dead, was about why the zombies. My introduction was about why the zombies, and we keep hitting it throughout. We get asked this a lot. So we think about this, and there are a lot of different answers, and they can all be right.
Well, see, that's what I find intriguing, because even though you thought a great deal about this, you really don't have a definitive answer. There's a possibility here, there's a model there.
I think they're all right. It's just like you can't have one answer for every car accident in Arizona.
Yeah.
I think all these factors figure in and why it comes together, why there's this sudden, where in the world did this zombie thing come from? Because there's not the one obvious cause. I think they all figure into it together.
Okay. Well, I've been trying to add Lloyd back into the conversation, and obviously somebody does not want Lloyd to be part of the conversation, which makes me really want to add Lloyd back in, because Martin must have something crucial to say. Martin, are you with us? I'm seeing a little icon. It's going beep, beep, beep.
Actually, he said he got a message saying, well, thanks for joining us, and so he gave up.
Oh, okay. Well, I will keep trying quietly to get him back. We only have a little while left in the program, a little over half an hour. So,
although since Marty left, we do seem to be having less trouble with the rest of us. Maybe it was one person too many.
Who knows? Who knows?
Or it was Marty's fault.
It's probably Martin's fault, yes. okay, let me see. Where do I want to take us now? Okay. Ross can actually, you know... Oh, wait a minute, wait a minute. Is he there? Martin, are you there? It says busy. What's he busy doing?
Listening to her.
Maybe he's watching Captain America. Okay, going back to the films, I'm really anticipating exciting things from this coming, you know, Captain America, but I'm a little bit, you know, discombobulated by the idea of a civil war. Is this meant to be a magnification of the Hydra in insinuation of itself into a S.H.I.E.L.D., or is this something else? Because they have, in this poster, they've got, you know, half is Steve Rogers and half is Tony Stark, and that makes one really wonder where they're going to go with this.
Well, of course, you know, we know the comic book story behind it as well, and it's... It wasn't tied into the Hydra kind of thing at all. It grew as a natural outgrowth. It's the same issue of who watches the Watchmen, who polices the police, which is a very big issue these days.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And
nothing
Civil
fictional
War,
about that.
This, yeah, so in the Civil War comic, you have this growing number of superheroes until a tragedy happens, and then, you know, some come in, it's like, okay, we need to regulate the superheroes, and others are, okay, we need the freedom to be unregulated so we can take on these fantastic enemies that other people can't face. And Captain America, who has always fought for freedom, is on the side of the superheroes having the greater liberty. And Iron Man, who's been for national security, is, you know, on the security side of it. There's a psychologist, Eric Fromm, who felt that the most basic human dilemma from when we are infants is the struggle between freedom and security. He felt this was the biggest thing driving human behavior throughout our lives, and you go back and forth. During times when we're worried about security, we'll give up all kinds of freedoms. And boy, we have seen that a lot.
We certainly have, haven't we not?
Yeah. And then it reaches a point, a breaking point, where people rebel against the increasing security because they want that freedom.
But
and
see, that's exactly the kind of social engineering that Iron Mountain was toying with.
Yeah.
And now we know they weren't toying with it. They were serious. And then you look around, and these films, to me, are stunning reflections. You know, Emily Dickinson used to have a great line that I fell in love with: tell all the truth, but tell it slant. And to me, the Marvel Universe is telling the truth of what's going on all around us, but it's telling it slant.
And that lets us look at it, where somebody might... If somebody were looking at a film about, you know, the government as it is manipulating individuals, that's a bit unnerving and hard to have fun with. But you then have the guy who's dressed as a flag and the guy with the science fiction robot armor, and that lets us look and have fun while also looking at these things that concern us. You wonder, what does go on? And you can look at the government and go, okay, no two people are going to be competent enough together to pull off some of these things. But that does, even if you feel that way, that doesn't mean there aren't people who want to try.
Mm. And, of course, as my friend Gene Roddenberry used to lay out, he said Star Trek is not about, you know, the 23rd century. Star Trek is about what's going on in America in 1965. So
that's what we're doing a Star Trek book for next summer.
Hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. My guests this morning, Travis Langley, Jaina Bush, Janina Scarlett, Martin Lloyd, who's been very quiet because he can't seem to connect and I can't connect with him. And that's obviously telling us we have to have him back solo someday. You're on the other side of midnight, and we shall return. We are back. You are on the other side of midnight with my guests this morning, Travis Langley and Jaina Bush, Janina Scarlett, and Martin Lloyd. Well, Martin Lloyd was with us. There's this little forlorn icon up on the right side of my screen saying, Martin, come in, Martin, come in. And it's not working. Okay, so we were talking about the Captain America Civil War, the coming film. See, seeing the narrative arc, seeing what they have laid as foundation for the idea that the Nazis are not safely dead and buried 50 years in the past, they're alive, they're around us, they're manipulating our culture, I cannot help but think that the story arc of the next film has to somehow involve that confrontation, that conflict, and bring it out into the open. Thoughts?
Well, I know from the comic book storyline that is not what was going on behind it, so it would be interesting if they do a different take with the film.
Well,
I honestly think they felt like it was too easy an answer.
Travis, did the other two films follow the comics? Because I don't know. I never used to read those comics.
The Winter Soldier, the story with Hydra having run S.H.I.E.L.D. is not exactly in the comics. S.H.I.E.L.D. has had big trouble. S.H.I.E.L.D. has had times when other people took over. But that exact story is not in the comics. Civil War is one they've been building to a long time.
That's what I think. And so
I'm just guessing based on the comics, and yeah, they can do it very differently. But shortly after the Civil War comics, there was this storyline in which it found out that these alien shapeshifters, the Skrulls, had replaced a number of superheroes. And so some of them were wondering, could that have been behind what caused the Civil War? It did not turn out to be the case. I think they decided they want to avoid the easy answer of having a villain of any kind be behind this trouble, because they wanted to say, no, it's the conflict between these individuals in and of itself that was the problem.
Yeah, and I think they may end up taking whatever
Jana, can you move a little closer to the mic, please?
Yeah, I think they'll end up taking whatever becomes of Hydra and connecting them with other villains. And the Hydra, they've been sort of touching on in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. There was a Hydra character in Ant-Man. But I don't really think that that's a large part of Civil War. From what I know, it seems to be much closer to the comics. Though we're not dealing with secret identities in the films the way we were with the comics. Mm.
See, when Jean was able to make the successful transition from Star Trek, the original series, through Star Trek Next Generations to the film, to the movies, one of the things, again, that was a disappointment for me was in Star Trek II, where he brought back Khan. The main conflict was so small, you know, Khan against Kirk, Kirk against Khan. When you've got the universe and you've got this incredible technology which can refashion, I mean, it's basically torsion field technology. The Genesis, you know, effect was torsion field technology where you can create actual or transform matter from the ether with some kind of a technological device or devices. To shrink that down to basically cops and robbers, I thought cheated the audience of a much bigger, more dramatic stage. And I'm just wondering, in this coming Captain America film, if they're reducing it to personalities, aren't we all going to kind of lose? Because they set up an incredible premise at the end of Winter Soldier. Incredibly interesting premise.
And that has played out a lot in the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. TV series.
See, I haven't watched that at all. Nope.
It's been erratic. I stayed with it longer than a lot of my friends, and then when I got bored was when everybody said, oh, it became much better.
Well, that's intriguing.
But they did. They've played out the Hydra storyline there a lot, and they have set up large things, but they also had, it's like, you know, well, Hydra's partly defeated, and so, yeah, they could. They certainly can, but... Because we don't know what they're using as the inciting incident to set off all of this in the Civil War. So in some cases, we're making a lot of guesses about what they might be doing.
Isn't that what they want us to do?
Yeah. Well,
the official synopsis says it's an international incident. So we don't know what that is.
It's an international incident?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now remember, at the end of the last film, the Winter Soldier film, you have that. And I really like the film guys doing this because I used to be one of those nuts that would sit in the theater and watch the credits. And what they've now done is they've snuck in other scenes in the credits for those people. And at the very end of Winter Soldier, they have this scene where you have another Nazi-looking general talking to a Confederate. You know, well, while they're all goose-chasing over there, they won't find all of us. And then I've got this secret thing, and then he shows this wand, you know, from Thor's brother, Loki, and talks about incredible power. I mean, of course, that's direct transformation of hyperdimensional torsion field physics into a technology. Duh. But then they show these two people, I guess brother and sister, and they have telekinetic and psychokinetic abilities, transhuman abilities, no technologies, just themselves able to manipulate space and time. And if they don't use that in the coming film, what was it there for?
They did.
They used it in the second Avengers movie.
Yeah, that was a major part of the second Avengers movie.
Okay. The Age of Ultron.
I haven't seen Age of Ultron yet.
See, that came into that. And I think you would be disappointed because it did not play up the Nazi villain too heavily. He gets eliminated kind of early to then go into the artificial intelligence enemy throughout the film.
Which is the Ultron persona.
Yes. So I think you would be kind of disappointed by how early the Nazi story ends in that film.
Yeah. Well, you realize, of course, all this Nazi super science and technology is, again, based on real history.
Yes.
Have you guys ever heard of General Kammler? Have you heard of the huge black ops R&D projects that Hitler set up under Kammler in Poland and Czechoslovakia to develop all kinds of really astonishing super weapons? Like, if you go to the other side of midnight, .com and you click on, again, the guest link, that takes you to the second page, the guest page. Scroll down below the video clip from Winter Soldier, and there is the flying wing, the Hydra flying wing from the end of the first Captain America film. Then you scroll down one more picture, and that is the actual Horton bomber that the Horton brothers, who developed this super, you know, non-vertical stabilizer flying wing aircraft technology in World War II at the end of the war, they actually proposed building something like this, and of course the film put it on the screen as an actual living technology. So I'm really, you're right, Travis, I'm very disappointed that they just dropped that, because that's where the real trail of breadcrumbs is leading, a la Iron Mountain.
And since they kind of let that fizzle out in that one, that's another reason I'm not so sure that they're going to
unless they bring
the
it back in Civil War.
Captain America movie.
Unless they bring it back in Civil War. I mean,
they could. They can. I suspect they're not going to.
And wait a minute.
I would love to be surprised.
My three agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. tonight on the show don't know. You don't have sources. No one's leaked you any documents. Hell, the CIA is admitting stuff now. Why can't
they let it? If we knew anything, we'd be blackballed for saying it.
Also, this is the kind of thing where we often turn the individuals that we often turn down opportunities to know things about some of this. Like I've had opportunities to see advanced screenings or know information about certain films and TV shows, and I usually turn them down because I want to watch it when everybody else watches it, so I can have that same experience.
Okay.
Spoilers are, unfortunately, they're part of my job. I hate it, but I will often be told things that I am not allowed to reveal years before the movie actually comes out. So,
but you can,
and sometimes it's fun to know.
You can,
it is.
Look, you can tell us. It's just the four of us now.
Oh, oh.
Martin's gone.
That's it. He would turn me in.
Well, he does have that prison connection, we know. Okay, where do we want to go from here? I'm very nervous about opening the lines because I don't want to drop all the rest of you, since Skype is being so bizarre. If you continue to scroll down the other side of midnight.com page, under the Horton bomber, there is a, by the way, there's a link there, number 4. You can actually read about the America bomber. This was the bomber that Hitler and Goering and Kammler wanted to use to drop nuclear weapons on New York and Washington and whatever. Talk about foreshadowing. Anyway, if you scroll down further, you will see Operation Paperclip, which was referenced in that video clip I played at the top of the show tonight. Paperclip actually did bring a whole bunch of Nazi scientists to the United States, many more than the 100 or so that are listed in this group shot, thousands actually, and scattered them through American industry. And we now know from various historical reports that most of these folks did not, basically abhor and deny and reject their Nazi past. They embraced it, and yet they worked in American industry for the space program, for the DOD, and as you may have read, and you probably should if you haven't, when Barra and I did Dark Mission, we documented the case where basically the Nazis took over NASA and began doing all kinds of missions on Hitler's birthday and all kinds of other arcane rituals that came out of, the Thule Society and other places. And yet most Americans, except in the films, have no connection with this actual living history.
Don't they actually use the term Operation Paperclip at one point?
Yes.
In that last Captain America?
Scarlett Johansson talks about Operation Paperclip, which is why we actually picked that clip from the film tonight. But most people, most millennials, haven't a clue that that's real because it's in fiction film. I mean, for many years, I've had people who've been urging me to write fiction, and I've told them, look, if I was to write fiction about what I have found, what we have discovered, what our teams and our colleagues around the world have figured out now on this extraordinary reality that we're not supposed to know about, it would forever poison the well for anyone taking our serious nonfiction work seriously. And since I have two psychologists and one fanatic fan here, is that an appropriate analysis? If I was to write what we know as fiction, would the facts that we have built it on be taken seriously as facts?
There are so many things that happen in history that It seems fantastic or involves just so many odd decisions that, yeah, it would be hard to get people to buy it as fiction. Fiction simplifies the world. It boils things down to the essence of the story. And when you get into it being a story as complicated as life really is, it's harder for people to accept that story. And it's like we go to the fiction because we want it to, you know, streamline life.
And at the same time, by reading about it in the fictional world, we might be more open and accepting of maybe another person's point of view or something in history that we might otherwise dismiss or not fully understand. Like in the comics in the Civil War, we read about the Superhero Registration Act, right, and how superheroes actually had to register and sort of identify themselves as such.
Wasn't that also part of the Smallville storyline?
Yes. Yes, it was. Yeah.
I haven't watched Smallville, but yeah, yeah, it sounds it like
was. It. You, wait. Someone said, Janina, you haven't watched Smallville?
No, I have not.
Oh, okay. Please watch Smallville. There's am I right, Travis?
Yes, it was a Vigilante Registration Act once you started having the costume superheroes pop up. So they got into it in Smallville, yes.
Yeah, I was talking about Smallville as the series because, to me, Smallville has all kinds of little Easter eggs hidden in it about the meta history of Superman and Earth connected to what's out there and who's out there and ancient civilization. Remember the Native Americans, Travis?
They figured in very much in about one-third of the way into the series,
yeah,
yes.
And then it went the way of, like, give me a break. You know, it kind of sounds like S.H.I.E.L.D. for you.
Well, I will definitely add that to my list.
Okay, we have someone who's trying to call, so let's see if we can add this person because they may have a question that we would not have thought of. Sean, you're on the other side of midnight. Turn down your device. What do you want to ask our panel?
The one lady that was talking about prison research in this?
That's Janina Scarlett.
I know that when I worked the prisons, the inmates would watch TV and they'd take on the role of different people that they saw on TV, and it seemed to be, you know, they'd do it for months at a time after they watched a movie or something.
For months? Janina,
yeah.
Does this sound familiar?
I don't exactly know how.
Sean? Maybe you want to expand because we may be losing Janina. This Skype tonight is very strange.
Well, I know I worked the prisons for like 10 years, and the inmates would watch a different movie that came on or something. They'd all watch it together, but in their own different cells and stuff. And then it seemed like for maybe 1 or 2 months after that movie that they took on the role of one of the characters in the movie. And it seemed to be a common thing that I saw in the prisons that the inmates would almost like role play, but they'd take on the role of different people in the movies.
Well, so you have these inmates where they've got such restrictions in their life, such narrow range of what they're able going to do. And, you know, I do know from when I visited prison and dealt with individuals who work in these areas that those inmates spend a lot of time bored, and they, you know, fill their time and their lives and their thoughts with a limited amount of material. I did a study several years ago in which I had people do personality assessments, and they rated themselves and some fictional characters to compare. And in one version of it, some prison inmates not only rated themselves and who they thought was the perfect person, but they rated Batman. And honestly, the prison inmates loved Batman more than college students did.
Really? Why?
Yes.
Why?
Well, Batman's a rebel.
Yeah.
Batman, you know, he does his own thing, and he's a strong character. I know you would think it's like this guy fights crime, but their attitude was Batman is cool.
So they identified with the rebel crime fighter, even though they were the criminals.
Yeah, they considered him also Batman. From their point of view, he's mainly fighting criminals who don't have anything to do with them. He's fighting clowns and so forth.
Ah.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting for what Sean said. Like, you see that with with children, really, that you see, you know, you watch Frozen and all of a sudden you're Elsa for a month. And, you know, and also, I mean, I started as an actor and I was on stage, so I was doing the same role for a year at a time, 8 shows a week. And you do find that you start taking on physical, like you walk differently or you speak differently. I think it's just something gets into your consciousness and it sticks, and it sticks with you for a while. And like Travis said, you know, when there's not a lot of input, input like that is going to stick around.
Did you hear the story about Johnny Depp and Whitey Bulger?
I have heard many.
When they were making that film, apparently Depp decided to stay in character 24/7. He became Whitey Bulger during the filming of that film.
Well, I mean, that's method acting, and that's
it's really extreme, I would think.
Yeah, and you know what? It works for some people. For some people, you have to be able to turn it off at night. Some people act, and some people live it.
Sean, do you have anything else for us?
No, thanks a lot, Richard.
Okay, Martin. Are you? No, Martin's still blinking. It's not.
The call worked.
Say again.
That call worked, though.
Yeah, that was a test. So, if anybody, we got a few minutes left. If you want to call and ask of our surviving guests, the others have turned into zombies, but I have two left.
I'm here.
Oh, Janine is back. Okay. She's returned from the dead. Sean was talking about this affinity for his prisoners, the folks he was interacting with, to identify with these characters. And my question was, did you see that in your data?
Yes. So actually in working with both the military and then one of my doctoral students is working with inmates, and we're trying to incorporate superhero therapy with inmates. We're definitely seeing that where, for people that are going through a hard time, especially, there's a lot of that desire to have a role model and in some ways to emulate a role model. And I think in some ways, maybe it produces hope. Maybe it produces an escape. Maybe it produces an...
Oh, did we lose her?
Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
Aww.
Yeah, see, Hydra's really out to get us tonight. Jenna, we have a few minutes here, so let's take it in a totally different direction.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
You're back. You're back, and there's someone calling in, so let's add Adam quickly before we lose him. Adam, you're on the air with three of my surviving four guests tonight. What do you want to ask?
Good morning. Well, I just wanted to call in. Actually, since the beginning of the show, I've really enjoyed the show and the topic, and I saw Winter Soldier when it came out.
I've only seen it 5 times now. No, seriously. And every time I see it, I see something new. I see something different.
Well, I've probably seen it more than that, but
okay. He's a little shy about admitting that he really likes to watch. Go ahead.
When I saw the show, I thought it was a very contemporary theme, and you know, this was one of the things that this came out before a lot of the NSA stuff hit.
You mean Edward
hit the
Snowden?
News. And you know, you go back and you know that show went into production probably about a year before, you know, it was released. And I just thought, in keeping with some of the themes of the show earlier tonight, you know, how do they know? I mean, they just really had a really
we're going to have Chris Carter on at some point, and as you know, X-Files is coming back. And that's one of the key things I'm going to ask Chris. You know, how did you know? Because so many of the things that he dealt with in X-Files, it's now out there. It's real. It's been going on. I mean, not the really weird stuff of, you know, guys crawling around in the sewer and turning into whatever. But there's so much about X-Files that is, again, this blur between fiction, reality, nightmare, and, oh, my God, it's really going on somewhere.
I just remember I wondered, did they get very lucky with their subject matter, or did they kind of know a little bit something that we didn't know? But
some of that's going to be the spirit of the times, the things that are on people's mind. Also, it's going to be a logical.
See, Travis always has a conventional explanation for everything. That's his default.
That's what I like to think about. That's how I like to think on things. It's not rejecting the other. It's just this is what I think about. Years ago, the Steve Canyon comic strip, the creator of that, he would look at an event going on in the world, and he would think about what would be a good way to deal with that problem, and then he would write that into his comics. And the government would get in touch with him sometimes asking, How do you know these things?
Well, there is a very, very classic case, and we got about 3 minutes left in the show. Back during World War II, John Campbell was the editor of a magazine called Astounding Science Fiction. In fact, John Campbell, as the editor, basically made Arthur C. Clarke and Isaac Asimov and Bob Heinlein and all the other giants, because he picked them from obscurity, he helped them mold their styles, and he helped them tell their stories, and they became the super giants that we now know. But it really was Campbell being the burr under their saddle blanket, urging them on. He wrote a story once about nuclear fission technology in a bomb, and he put it in the magazine, and the FBI descended on him as the magazines were physically being carted around New York to be put on newsstands, and he actually was forced by the government to bring back all the magazines and destroy them because they did not want the Nazis to know that there was, in fact, a technology that would make an atomic bomb possible, because apparently what he'd written in his fiction was exactly the way you make an atomic bomb, and they were terrified that the secret would get out. And the next thing was, how the hell did he know? Did he have leaks from, the Manhattan Project? So this fact and fiction, fiction leading fact, is not untoward, except in these areas, we're not supposed to know that all this physics and technology that is, you know, glitters and is out there on the screen, in fact, could have a substrate of reality. We've got another caller. Let me see. We've got a couple of minutes here. Quick, get in just under the wire.
Okay, I'll be quick. Fiction simplifies life. I've been trying to get my head around that. Here's one for you. Reality is for people who can't handle their drugs.
And with that, I would like to say,
like that a lot.
Hey, everybody, I really enjoyed this evening. I must have you back. The Other Side of Midnight is richer for your experience this morning. I'm sorry we kind of had a fatality Martin, but we will have him back. There is a show being planned. We will make him part of the show. So I want to thank my guest this morning, Jenna Bush, Janina Scarlett, and Travers Langley, for giving us an extraordinarily intriguing insight into the world on the other side of midnight. So until next week, Tuesday morning, same time, same bat channel, remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night.